there's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is October 17th, 2024. It's a Thursday. That means we have a great lineup for you, as usual, from the Expert Council. Here's what we got for you today. How about this? Will we see U.S. troops on U.S. soil using lethal force on American citizens? This is a discussion between Dan McAdams and Dr. Paul. Now, they're keying in on a specific thing that just happened. I'm going to tell you why I'm not that concerned about the thing that just happened, but why that doesn't mitigate the actual issue of this is the real question. Do you think American troops will fire on American citizens? There's so many people in our space that say no. I'm going to follow up their discussion on this with why I think the answer is absolutely yes, and some dynamics I think that need to be understood. Patrick Rohrman will talk about keeping those kitchen knives sharp. Andy McCann will talk about what do you do when you miss that gym day. Joel Riles will talk about training a dog to remain inside a perimeter. Kerry Brown will talk about plants you can forage across most of the eastern United States. Doc Bones will talk about brushing up on your hurricane prep plans, and that's something that's very timely right now. And then I have a question that I'm going to answer for you. What happens when 90% of useful education becomes free or cheap and on demand? Do you know that right now there's over 600 plus free on-demand AI and cloud computing courses you could take on Amazon across like almost the whole world? Like, it's in like 30 different languages. In fact, if you look at all the tech giants like Amazon and Microsoft and other large companies, including some we wouldn't think of as tech giants, but they're driven by technology, there's over 10,000 free courses right now you can take. Did you know that? 10,000 free courses that you can take. I have a bit of a business opportunity in this that I'm going to drop on you when we talk about it. Like, while I'm talking about opportunities in education declining, you know what it means when you have opportunities in a sector declining? If the demand for what's in that sector is not declining, if it's only the willingness to pay for certain things, that opens up the door to something we call disruption. Disruption. And these free courses are a disruption, but there's other opportunities for disruption. With that, let's go ahead and get on into it hear from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams on will U.S. troops ever fire on U.S. citizens? And keep in mind, that's already happened in the past.
But we want to start off with a headline from Zero Hedge. It's a pretty hot headline. U.S. military now is authorized to kill Americans on U.S. soil. That can't be possible.
Yeah.
This would open up the door for the careless use, and if more frequent, and legal. It'll be legal now, so nobody will have to worry about that. Send in the troops. We need you to shoot a couple of these people.
Yeah.
They're opposing our policies. They're demonstrating against COVID rules or something they'll come up with. So I think it's very, very dangerous.
So here it is. Now, Zero Hedge picked it up from Armageddon Prose, which is a Substack, which they often run. It says, U.S. military now authorized to kill Americans on U.S. soil? Just ahead, intriguingly, of November elections, and that was my second thought, the military has granted itself permission to unleash lethal force on the civilian population. Again, I thought this has got to be an exaggeration, so I went and looked, and actually go to the next one, because this explains what it is. Now, it's not a law. It's a DOD directive. So this is, you know, the administrative state where they take over. They don't pass laws. They are laws unto themselves. Go to the next one if you can, because this is what they're talking about. And I went in and I read this secondly. And it talks about a reissued DOD directive that was reissued just on September 27th, 2024. It governs the Department of Defense intelligence activities and now includes provisions authorizing lethal force in certain circumstances. And it supplants the 2016 version, which did not mention that. So I read all of this, too, which is someone else's analysis. I said, okay, this sounds even more troubling. I want to go look at the document itself. And so go to the next one. I actually went and looked at the DOD directive. It's DOD directive 5240.01. Now go to the next one. I'm just going to get to this really quick so I can, just so people, this is on their own website. Now this is section 3 of that directive, assistance to law enforcement agencies and other civil authorities. Now go to the next one. Now this is levels of authority. This is section 3.3. Defense intelligence components may provide personnel to assist a federal department or agency, including a federal law enforcement agency or a state or local law enforcement agency, when lives are in danger, in response to such a request for such assistance in accordance with the following approval authorities. Now, here are the authorities. I'm sorry to get so far into the woods here, but go to the next one. Responding with assets with potential for lethality, and I underline this, I highlighted it, or any situation where it is reasonably foreseeable that providing the requested assistance may involve the use of force that is likely to result in lethal force, including death or serious bodily injury. I'm sorry to bog the discussion down with that, Dr. Ball, but I really wanted to hone in on this as their actual document. It's not just someone's analysis.
So I checked, and I really didn't need to, because if it comes from Dr. Paul's team, it's valid. And everything they said is valid. This is why I remain unmoved by it. Did you think it really required this for that to happen? Did you? Did you think that this, like, yesterday before this happened, troops would never fire, but now they'll just go out and shoot everybody? The real issue here is something that's in the mind and hearts of patriots everywhere in this country is, will the United States military fire on American citizens? Well, now that they have this piece of paper, shut up. I'm sorry, shut up. This piece of paper has nothing to do with the answer. Let me tell you what the answer is. Yes. Yes, they will. Yes, they will. Yes, they will. They will fucking shoot you in your own home if they are ordered to do so. Why? Because the military is trained to follow fucking orders. Now, they're also trained not to follow illegal and or immoral orders, but that training kind of goes to the back of the line. Let me explain something else about this. We're leaving one really important psychological component out of this question. And that is, what happens when people start acting in a mob? This is a military, not a mob. Hold on. Think about this. How many people do you think took part in things like the BLM riots and broke into stores and grabbed TVs and ran away and did shit like that who, without the mob action, would not have? How many people do you think went through a broken window, grabbed some shit and ran away with it and took it home, who up until that day had never committed a significant crime? I mean, we all commit crimes, right? We probably all commit crimes every day because there's so many laws about so many things you don't even know about. Every time you get in your car, you probably break 20 traffic laws in a 20-mile drive. Speeding, fails to say, like, but I'm saying, like, theft, like vandalism, you know, like assault. How many people do you think committed their first real crime during the first riot that they were part of? The answer is a lot. The answer is a lot. There was an experiment done back in, it was in the 50s or the 60s, maybe it was the 70s. I think it was redone in the 70s, originally done in the 50s or 60s, where these children and children, young adults in college, were put in a place where they could, when a person said something the wrong way, they could shock them. And they weren't really shocking them, but they didn't know that. You know, they got the professor in the lab coat, and they were told that if the person was shocked sufficiently enough, it could seriously harm them or even kill them. But they should do what the instructor tells them to. And roughly 70 to 75% of these people, when they thought they were at the threshold of either really hurting or killing a person, still pushed the button when they were told to. Okay, now let's analyze this, especially from You know, who are they going to send to do this? They're not going to send Navy SEALs to do this. They're not going to send Special Forces or Air Force Power Rescue. They're going to send garden variety troops from either the regular Army or Marine Corps or the Marine Corps Reserve or Guard. That's who they're going to send to do this. People that are trained to shoot things, right, and not to think too much about it. And how are those people trained? Compliance, obedience, uniformity. See, there's a very important word in there that gets missed by so many people who have never served. Uniformity. This is drilled into you from day one. It's how you line up your gear in formation. It is how you set up your gear at your rack. It is everything that you do is uniformity. It is when you are in a position, let's say, present arms with a rifle in your hand. Everybody's muzzle of everybody's rifle is at the same level as it is in relation to their body. Do you understand me? Everything is to be uniform. Everything is to be uniform. Everything is to be uniform. So when they're given an order and their sergeant says we're doing it and their sergeant pulls the trigger, they all pull the fucking trigger too. And you see it with cops. And it's more true of the military than police, because military are more highly disciplined to comply with what they're told to do than cops. But you see it with cops. Fucking cop tells the guy to put... there's a legitimate shoot, by the way. Put the fucking knife down. Guy comes at the cop with the knife. Cop shoots the fucking guy. Five other cops dump fucking magazines in. Why? Because mob mentality kicks in. Do you think they're going to just say, hey, we want you to go out and just lay waste to this formation of people with picket signs peacefully protesting in the middle of a field? No. No, especially not at first. No, they would send it out into something that looks like the Black Lives Matter riots if you know, they didn't actually want it to happen at the time. So you're talking about people committing arson and assault and God knows what else. And did you ever think that anybody armed in their duty was ever obligated not to fucking kill you if they felt their life or the life of somebody else in any other situation was threatened, especially if they're told to do it? So this is the problem that this country has, especially on the right. You believe in fucking fantasy. You believe that this piece of paper changed something. It didn't change anything. It didn't change one damn thing. The threat is there. It just was in August. It was 2 years ago. It was 10 years ago. It was 70 years ago. The first time this was ever kind of spelled out is in something called the NDAA. That's the National Defense Authorization Act. The first time it was put in place was under Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It has been reauthorized like a rubber stamp every time it has come up. And if you go there, it says they can do this shit in there. When I first heard about this, I didn't even know this was a new document. I was like, they do that every couple of years. They reauthorize it. So they just put it somewhere else. They have always been willing to shoot you. They always will be willing to shoot you because the number one instinct of the state as an organism is survival and growth. And if you stand in the way of it, like any organism that feels its survival is threatened, it will act with violence and it will kill you. That's the reality here. I wish it was better, but it's not. Let's move on and hear about keeping our knives sharp with Patrick Rohrman, something a little less dark.
Hey guys, it's Patrick with MT Knives coming to you today with today's Expert Counsel segment of the week. Today's question comes from Eric. This question is for Patrick Rohrman. What is the best way to sharpen kitchen knives? Is it better to take it to someone who knows how to sharpen knives, or can we get good results by sharpening them ourselves? There's a booth at our local farmer's market with a guy who sharpens knives. We wondered if it's worth the money to have him sharpen them, or if we can buy the sharpening tools we need to do it ourselves. We have two sets of kitchen knives, an older set we got when we got married 24 years ago, and a good set we got about 10 years ago. Both have never really been sharpened, other than maybe running it over a stone with not really any knowledge of how to do it correctly. Thank you. Eric, I'm going to mess up his last name, but Vanderwall, I'm going to answer this question the best I can with the information I have. However, it'd be helpful to know how much the guy at the farmer market charges, what are the makes and models of the knives that you have, and some of that information. I recently was watching a video about sharpening and the guy was kind of complaining about people teaching people how to sharpen with not an aggressive enough stone. And this is why I always recommend people not trying to learn how to sharpen on a knife that hasn't been sharpened in 25 years. If you're going to practice on a knife that hasn't been sharpened in 25 years, you need a super aggressive stone, maybe, you know, a diamond stone that's super coarse, because it's going to require a lot of steel removal to get that knife sharp. I tend to recommend people have a knife professionally sharpened and then start to sharpen as it starts to lose its edge. And so then at that point, you can start with something like a 1,000 grit water stone. That's what I recommend people do, not to try to tackle a knife that hasn't been sharpened in 25 years. That's my recommendation. Have the knife sharpened and then maintain it. And the reason for this is because a lot of times when people try something out for the first time, if they fail, they just give up and they decide that they can't do it. So it's best to try to set yourself up for small victories, small successes. So I do like trying to learn how to sharpen on a kitchen knife because it's larger and it's easier to kind of tell the angle that you're working on. But I also recommend somebody that's trying to sharpen a knife like that to focus on one spot of the blade, like 1 inch of blade, because to sharpen a full kitchen knife is going to take more work because it's such a large blade. So that's my recommendation. Now, as to the guy from the farmer's market, I have seen knives damaged by people who charge people to sharpen knives. And I've seen so many people out there that are sharpening knives that really just shouldn't be sharpening other people's knives. So it's hard for me to recommend somebody take a knife to somebody who I have no idea of their skill level, their qualification, and so forth. I do sharpen knives. You can send your knives to me to have them sharpened. It's not something that I try to do a lot of because I have enough work to do besides the sharpening, and I don't want to spend my time sharpening knives all day long. So it's also, you know, not cheap, but it's done right. If you'd like to send your knives to me, go ahead and send me an email and I'll go over the process of getting some knives sharpened. As far as what tools do I recommend, the King 1000 Grit Waterstone has been what I've recommended over the years. I have some different thoughts now. My recommendation might vary based on the person, their budget, and what they want to do. I'm going to have some new videos coming out where I review different stones, some other options, diamond, water stones, oil stones. But the King 1000 Grit is great if you're going to do, like I said, have it professionally sharpened and then just stay on top of the maintenance with that. If you were going to try to sharpen the knives that you have that haven't been sharpened for 25 years, I would recommend starting with something more aggressive and probably something mechanical. The other thing, when you have a knife like that that hasn't been sharpened in many years, depending on the use of it, the blade profile, anytime you get into removing a lot of steel or doing it mechanically, you can alter the profile of the blade. So that's where a professional knows how the profile should look and can maintain the profile of that blade without changing it. Thank you for your question, Eric. If any of you guys have a question, feel free to send it to me, patrick@mtknives.net, and I'll do my best to answer the questions as I can. Thank you very much. This has been Patrick Rohrman with MT Knives. Have a great day.
And Patrick is far more advanced on this topic than me. I would just say that one thing you might add to that advice is go down to like Dollar Tree or something and pick up some $2, $3, $4, $5 knives. Just some shitty ones. And, you know, they're going to come sharp-ish and, you know, use them enough to where they just don't shave hair anymore. And sharpen those and make that like your first thing you do is learn how to sharpen a really cheap, shitty knife. There's a couple things going on here. One, they're going to have shitty, cheap, soft steel. It makes it a little easier to do. But the bigger thing is, if you mess it up, you don't care. And I think one of the biggest things that people learning to sharpen knives lack is confidence. And, you know, if you get a really nice knife, you're afraid you're going to mess it up. even if you would not have, by being afraid you're going to mess it up, you might. I mean, it'll always be fixable, but you know, you can do some things that you really shouldn't do. On getting it sharpened, I would kind of take a similar piece of advice with determining how good the person doing the sharpening is. Give them a, you know, something that's not a $20-$30 knife, you know, that needs some love. Let them sharpen it for you. See how you like what they did. And learn what to look for. I'm sure if you go to Patrick's YouTube channel and check on some of his sharpening videos, he'll tell you about how to look at a knife edge and how to feel the sharpness of a knife edge differently than most people do it. Because a lot of times, okay, that knife seems sharp, but it may not really have been treated well. I've had people bring me knives and say, look, I took it and got it sharpened, and like I look at the blade, there's like pieces of steel missing out of it. Oh, it's sharp, but they've really had their edge jacked up badly by people using, a lot of times, these like belt-driven sharpeners, these, you know, somehow electric component to the sharpeners. Those are great tools, but you got to know what you're doing. And a lot of these people at like farmers markets and all, they don't. So let them earn your business by giving them something you're not going to be completely worked up about, you know, an inexpensive folder or something. See how it does, how long it holds an edge, etc., before you go bring your whole collection of kitchen knives to them. Anyway, moving on, let's go ahead and hear from Andy McCann on missing a day at the gym.
Good morning. This is Andy McCann over here in Woodstock, Georgia, helping you be healthy and fit. I do a podcast called Fitness, Food, and Finances, because if you're going to be healthy and live a long time, you better have those finances too. And I'm here to answer those questions. So the one I got today is an interesting one, and it doesn't really occur to me because I just have a natural habit of this. But Andy, what do you do when you miss a day at the gym? So first thing is, don't stress on it. If you miss a day at the gym, that is totally okay. I put in my calendar, do something 5 days a week. If I miss that, that's okay, because my goal is to do four things a week. And five is just gold, but four is what I really want. So if I totally miss because, I don't know, life has demands, then that's okay. My thing is, don't stress. Have a plan. Have it worked in your system that you're doing more than you had planned on already. So I use my Google Calendar. I have an hour blocked out for working out. And then when life goes astray, so basically I work out in the morning usually. But right now my daughter's learning to drive. She has two more weeks before she gets her license. So I'm spending a lot of time in the car with her because I want her to live. So it messes up my schedule completely. But I move that 1 hour around, so it's not in the morning, and move it to the afternoon if I can get it done. If it just so happens that I can't, if she's running cross country and I got to go pick her up, then I'll just get there early and I'll do a run. So one, don't stress. Two, make sure it's in the schedule, and then when you do move it around, just do something. It doesn't really matter what you do. Okay, so let's say I did miss and I want to do something because, hey, I'm going to only get 3 days at the gym, so I'm going to do something at home or I have missed, what now? Okay. I look at the schedule. When can I do the thing? Depending on what I can do and how long I've got, that's what I'm going to plan. So I do have a lot of gear in my basement. Some of it is broken stuff from our gym. But anyway, I'll go downstairs and let's say I only have 15 minutes. Then I may do one of my favorite ones is to jump on the Rogue bike, the Echo bike, and I'll do a Tabata style workout in reverse. So usually you do 20 seconds of work with 10 seconds off, and you do that for a while. So I'll do a couple rotations, maybe 12 minutes of it, and my warm-up is just start doing it. So I'll get on the bike, and I'll do 20 seconds of rest, so I'll just bike nice and easy, and then when it gets to the 10 seconds, I'll start hammering. So I hammer for 10 seconds, and then I relax for 20 seconds, and then I hammer again. So I like that one. I'm usually going to go around 8 to 12 minutes. I like the fact that I've got some time frame in there, so there's, you know, 12 minutes maybe of working out, but there's also 10 seconds every, you know, 20 or 30 seconds of intense effort, and that's huge. The intensity that you move out is big. Now, that doesn't happen all the time, and maybe, I don't know, maybe I don't feel like riding the bike. I have a rower right there. I typically do not do Tabata style on a rower. I just don't like the way that makes me feel in my back. Usually, I'm going to pick a time domain, and I'm going to go, and I'm just going to try to row for that time domain. The next one I do is I've got a two-mile route set up for, well, I guess we did it for cross country when she was doing 2 mile, the race was 2 miles. So I'll just get out and do that. And the warm-up is I walk down the driveway, and then I start going. I don't even time that. I'm just out there doing a thing. If I'm not into the distance or the weather isn't permitting it or something like that, my next go-to is I have two 25-pound dumbbells, and I do thrusters with them. I'll do thrusters and burpees, or thrusters in row, or thrusters in sit-ups, or something, right? So a thruster is basically you take the weights, put them up on your shoulders, you're going to squat down, and then you are going to stand and drive the weights up. So basically, you're thrusting the weight into the sky. That is by far one of the best movements you could ever do. That's typically my go-to, and my biggest one I'm going to tell you guys is don't stress too much. Okay, next thing I want to give you, Jack, you jerk. So I don't know why I didn't think of this, but Jack has now spawned another business idea for me. And you know me, the perfect is the enemy of done. So we launched, I've gathered three other guys to help me do this, and we launched a garage fitness online. So if you have a sort of a gym, some things in there, then you can join us. Finally, I have something to give you guys. I've got Brandon Phillips, who has been doing programming for health and fitness for the last 20 years. He's teamed up with me to put the program out there. I've got my two nerd buddies, who I guess I'm a nerd as well, but they know how to do automation and all this, so they're going to help me run a program that might have thousands of people in it. We're going to do some cool things. So I got this from Jack as well. Like what Jack said, hey, what if I had somebody train an AI, a small language model, on all the podcasts I did? Then you could click in and be like, hey, give me the advice. And you'd be able to talk to them. I thought, man, that is awesome. I've got some podcasts. We could probably do something like that. So we've got these cool ideas. It's just starting. So it's probably, by the time you listen to this, we're probably only days or weeks into launching. But guys, you can go join us there. I'll give Jack the link. But you can find us on Facebook, probably the easiest way, which I know is not great, but it's Garage Fitness Online. You can find it there. You can try to find, well, you can find the landing page. I'll give it to Jack, but it's off my main site because, again, perfect is the enemy of done. But let me back up and say, if you miss at the gym, that's okay. Go easy, go small, do something. Don't stress. Put more days of working out than you really need. That way, if you miss, it's not too bad. The other is, if you're looking for a group of people to help motivate you and programming that's solid and you want to follow, then jump on this. I'm basically building it for you guys out there because I want to help. There was a problem, and I'd like to solve it. All right, you guys take care. Again, this is Andy McCann helping you with your fitness, food, and finances, helping you to live a good life now, or even when you're 90 with all that health and money. Take care.
So great tips for making up that missed workout at home or wherever you are. I'm going to come at this a little bit different, a much briefer answer, but my view is when you miss a day at the gym, you miss a day at the gym. Like, if you want to do a different workout or something, go ahead. But the real issue is don't miss the next one. Don't miss the next one. So the entire reason that you care about missing the day at the gym isn't that one day is going to make or break your success long term, because it's not. You will not be any more harmed by missing one day at the gym in a year or a month than going to the gym one day per year or per month. You see what I'm saying? But what we end up doing when we put ourselves into a workout routine is we form a habit. And it generally takes about 7 or 8 consistent cycles, whatever that cycle is, of doing a thing before it becomes a habit. If it's a daily thing, 7, 8 days, you can create a habit. It's that easy. The thing is, like, it takes 7, 8, 10 times to form a habit when it's something that takes effort that we would actually, in some ways, even if we want to do it, we kind of would like to avoid it. It takes 2 or 3 to develop a habit when it comes to avoiding something that requires less effort to not do than to do. So my big advice here is when you miss a day of anything, working, I don't care what it is, if you go off your diet for a day, it's not a big deal, but you better not do it 2-3 days in a row, because all of a sudden you'll find yourself right back in the negative cycle instead of the positive one, and it just takes more cycles to create that habit to the positive than to the negative, because the negative is the path of lesser resistance in the short term anyway. And let's talk now about keeping dogs inside a perimeter without a fence with Joel Riles.
Hello everyone, this is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy, coming back to you again with another expert counsel question. And today's question is about how to teach a livestock guardian dog to, quote, stay home or stay in the area that they're supposed to. Now, Nick may have already answered this because I was looking back through my questions and it's a little bit of an older question. I apologize for the delay. But I wanted to take it from the approach of, let's teach any dog to stay on the property and not rush off of the property. Now, there's a couple of approaches you can take when doing this. The simplest, although it's a little bit more on the expensive side, is to install one of those invisible fences and train the dog to the invisible fence, which you simply walk them around the perimeter, allowing them enough movement in the lead that they can get close to where they're not supposed to be, so that they experience, oh, I get shocked if I go over there. Over here, there's no discomfort, right? And they'll very quickly learn, okay, there's the edge of my perimeter that I can walk in, and I'll stay inside of that. So that's your simplest option, although you're going to pay for the simplicity, right? You'll pay for the savings of the time that it's going to take to do the other methods. The other methods are what we do with our dogs is some dogs will respond to just using the lead, and others will actually need like a correction, such as with an e-collar, right, the shock collars. So you have to kind of pay attention to your dog and see which one they're responding to. But we walk the perimeters with our dogs, and we tell them perimeter. And then as I walk the perimeter with my dog, at first, I'm keeping them in basically a foos, which is to walk at my side like a heel, right? And they're staying with me at my side, and we're walking the perimeter, and I'm telling the dog, good perimeter, good perimeter. So as we're walking, they're learning this is the perimeter, right? They're learning to associate that word with walking that route. And we walk the same route every time we do it. And then I start telling the dog, I go out, and I have my 6 or 7 foot lead, and I start telling the dog, walk the perimeter. And I kind of step back and let them walk out a little bit in front of me, but I still have a hold of the lead. Now, I'm close enough to my edge, right, that if they start to get over in an area they're not supposed to, I go, fui that, back over into the perimeter, right? And then, but if they go the other way, away from the edge, I don't discourage that at all. So they start to move toward the edge, I give them a little bump with the lead, and I say, fui that, back over into the perimeter. And so we walk until I can run them with a 30-foot long line. And, you know, or you can run a rope or something like that, but you let them have 15, 20, 30 feet, right, of movement, and you're just watching. Anytime they start to move in the direction you don't want them, fui that, get back into the perimeter. And if you need to, a pop with the lead, right? Now, the other thing that you can do, if that's not working, right, the dog's not responding to that, is you can actually use an e-collar. Now, there's going to be two things to keep in mind if you're using the e-collar. This also will apply somewhat if the dog, when you're with them, will stay in the perimeter, right? But then when you're not, they want to roam, okay? So if they're roaming when you're not there, but first let me back up one step. If you're using the e-collar, you can essentially use it exactly the same way we just mentioned with the lead, right? So instead of using a pop on the lead if they go the wrong way, you just have the e-collar. What you want to set it to is just enough that it's uncomfortable enough that the dog moves back in. Right? So maybe 20 to 25% of max. So they're all different in how you adjust them. So if I want to end a bad behavior, I typically go 50 to 70%. If there's an aggression problem, I just go all the way to the max. And if it's something like this where I'm training the dog, I want to be somewhere in the 20 to 25% range. Now, you still have to watch the dog. Some dogs will respond to a very low setting, and other dogs, you have to crank it up. So don't go right to 20%. Start at like 10, 15, 20. To play in there with it to see, okay, where is the dog actually reacting, and they'll come back into the perimeter. However, if they do it when you're with them, whether you use the e-collar or the lead, and then when you're not around, they start wandering, well, then you have two options. The first option is you set up that fence again if you don't want to keep putting in the time. The second option, though, if you have the time, is observe the dog. Right, so only let them free, totally free, certain times of the day when you can observe them. And as long as they're staying within the perimeter, you have the e-collar, right, the remote. And if they're staying within the perimeter, nothing bad happens. They start exploring right at that edge, pop them. And they go, whoa, okay, don't stay near the edge too long. But don't associate yourself with it. So you're not going to say anything. You're not going to react. You're just going to sit back and passively observe and then pop them whenever they get close to the edge. Right. And if they go over the edge, what I normally do is I'll run. There's usually a like single pop, and then there's a continuous button on the remotes. So if they go, if they just walk right past the edge, I run the continuous until they run back in, and then I stop it. So they think, oh, if you step out there, just keep shocking you until you come back in here. I don't want that. Right. Now, you're going to have to do this a little while, but pretty quickly they'll associate without you being around. Don't go over there or you'll get shocked. All right. Now, these aren't 100% foolproof. Fencing is your ideal thing. If you can put up like a 6-foot chain link fence, Some dogs will learn to jump it, but most won't. And if it's a big enough space, most of the dogs won't try to dig under it and things like that. So fencing is your ideal, but if you don't have fencing and you're trying to teach a dog perimeter, those are the techniques and methods that we use. So I hope that's been helpful for you. If you want more information on training a dog you already have, you can always check out canineacademy.us. If you are listening to this on Jack's show, please go to thesurvivalpodcast.com. Click on his banner there so that Jack gets credit for it. We have an affiliate program set up with him. If you don't have a dog and or you're looking for a working line Dutch Shepherd, German Shepherd, or Malinois for family protection, just an active lifestyle, you want an untrained puppy all the way up to a fully trained protection dog, check out fortresscanine.com. Remember, until next time, train hard and stay safe.
All right, now let's talk about foraging. Kerry Brown's going to talk about finding plants that you can forage across a broad swath of the United States, in this case from up as far northeast as New York down into the, you know, area around like in Florida. And there are some plants that are available throughout that range, but as you'll hear, they're available at different times of the year.
Hey, TSP community. It's Kerry Brown from Strong Roots Resources, and today I'm answering a question from Jim the Snowbird. Jim wants to know, is there one or more edible plants that I will be able to find from New York to Florida? And for more context, he says he wants to forage all along the East Coast as he travels in boondocks. Other than harvesting park squirrels and rabbits, are there plants that I'll be able to find in the Northeast as well as in the Mid-Atlantic states and Florida? Thanks to Jack and all the experts. From Jim. So the quick answer is yes, absolutely, and you don't have to worry about being stuck on just one thing, because there are several things that you will be able to find throughout this entire region. Keeping in mind, depending upon which direction of travel, you know, of course, as you go north, you're kind of going backwards in time. So keep that in mind as you plan out your travels, Jim. But here's what I got for you. So it's a big list. It actually is a pretty big list. The common one that probably everybody is going to come up with first is dandelion. But the nice part about dandelion is that it's got a pretty extended season. So I will continue to find greens that are still worth harvesting in different little microclimates here at home, even when it's a little bit hot and in other areas they've gone to seed. The other nice thing about dandelion is that all of it is edible. So the young leaves, you can eat them raw or cooked. If you do cook them, this is like light cooking. At the end of the stir fry is what I usually suggest. The flowers are edible as well and can be used in salads, or if you've got the equipment to brew, you can make a really good wine and, you know, teas and just really all kinds of stuff with those flowers. And the root has a variety of medicinal uses. I might need to double check this in one of my books, but I believe it's traditionally been used as a liver and a blood tonic. So all parts of the dandelion. Then another option is going to be wild garlic. Here in Tennessee, these start popping up early spring after we're kind of through with, we're through with the actual cold and we're still kind of having those swings of weather. And wild garlic, kind of also referred to as wild onion, depending upon who you ask. The greens are edible. They're a great way to dress up and add some flavor to something, and the bulbs are edible as well. And some of them can be very strong, so perhaps test one before you chop and add a whole bunch to your meal. The nice thing is that they tend to come up in clumps, so you can drop your spade in the soil and pop out a clump or two and have quite a bit to work with for a meal that day to go with your squirrel and rabbit. Another one of my personal favorites, and we get this in abundance up here, this usually starts coming up around, I'm going to go with maybe mid to late March, again, kind of just depends on the weather, and that's chickweed. And it will hang around until usually by early to mid-May, we're usually too hot, the chickweed has flowered and set seed and has died back. But it is, it kind of grows in like a mat. So it's another one that's very easy to harvest. It's not very deeply rooted, so you can just kind of pull up a corner and kind of just roll it up. And I'm almost certain, and I bet this would be a good question for Dowie, I think chickweed is essentially nature's microgreens. So, you know, get you some inexpensive to free microgreens in the form of chickweed. Cattails are another one. So you're going to find these on, you know, on wetter landscapes. Very common to see in ditches along roadsides. The young shoots, the roots, and the flower spikes are edible. And the root, if you're motivated, can be processed into kind of like a flour as in baking substitute. Another one of my very favorites, and this is a this is something that continues to be edible as a wild green even now into late summer, and that is lamb's quarters. You can eat those leaves raw, or they can be cooked, and when you cook them, they taste quite a bit like spinach. I like them, and they're one of the ones that even as they start to get tall and start to make a little bit of seed, they're still edible. They're a little bit more bitter, but not like the other stuff. So that's a wild green that hangs around all summer. Purslane is a very low-growing succulent. It literally hugs the ground. Its favorite environment is cracks and sidewalks. And those leaves and stems are pretty good. I enjoy them. And apparently are also high in fatty acids, omega-3s. Nettle is another option. Those young leaves can be cooked, but they do have those little hairs that sting, so keep that in mind. Cooking them will take away that stinging aspect. And nettles are known for having a lot of anti-inflammatory properties and being pretty nutrient-dense. You're going to find blackberries and raspberries all through. So this is one of those where you definitely want to kind of pay attention to what season you're in relative to the region. But, you know, anywhere that there's been disturbed land, any old, you know, common at forest edges, common in old pastures and that sort of thing, you're going to see all your bramble fruits. Acorns are another option, but they are kind of time-intensive, effort-intensive to soak, to leach out the tannins, and then to grind and make a flour. But if you are in, you know, deciduous woodland, you're probably going to have some acorns around. And then finally, plantain. And I'm throwing plantain in here. It's not as much an edible, but it is a very, very useful medicinal because if you're in the parks and if you're boondocking all around, pretty good chance that you're dealing with wasps, possibly yellow jackets, that sort of thing. And plantain is wonderful for applying. We like to chew it up and then apply it to wherever you just got stung. So there you go, Jim. You've got lots of stuff available to you. So you know, keep in mind where you're at and what time it is of you know what time of the year it is relative to your region, and you're going to be able to learn to identify these things, and you'll find them from Florida to New York and back again. So thank you for sending in that question. It was my joy to answer it for you. And for the audience, just want to let everybody know that we do a weekly live stream every Friday, 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we've got it's mostly around the topics of foraging, homesteading, property improvement, a little bit of prepping. We just kind of cover the gamut. So. If you'd like to learn more about the wild, edible, medicinal, and otherwise useful species on your land, I offer in-person property walks, foraging classes here on our farm, and consulting and education, as well as ID, GPS tagging, and documentation of all those species on your property. And I've got about a four-hour travel radius from Knoxville, so feel free to reach out at strongrootsresources@gmail.com. Y'all have a good week, and I will talk to you next time.
Good stuff there, and I think foraging is a skill that we should all develop a great deal of. When I remember conversations when I was a child with my grandfather about the Depression, foraging played a huge part in how they adapted to that period of time. Next up, let's hear about hurricane preparedness from Doc Bones.
Hi, Joel Nemdy here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. With the devastation caused by the recent hurricane, I realize that I've written plenty about storm safety, but I've never really talked about it here. so as usual, I have some thoughts I'd like to share. Every year around this time, the U.S. can expect storms to menace the east and Gulf coasts. Despite plenty of warning, many citizens, even those who consider themselves prepared, still find a way to get caught by surprise, with more than 160 deaths caused by the recent Hurricane Helene. Hurricanes certainly can be dangerous, but they don't have to be life-threatening for those who prepare. Even before it's clear that your area is in danger of being hit by the storm, you should have considered factors like food, water, power, and shelter. Here are a few tips to help those preparing for the worst while hoping for the best. You'll know some of them, but I'll bet you don't know all of them. The first and maybe most important is to make a good decision. That's G-O-O-D, get out of Dodge decision. Rugged survivalist, well, you might want to ride out the storm, but many coastal residents would be best served by hitting the road. When the authorities say it's time to evacuate, you really should be ready to go. Don't forget to turn off the power, gas, and water before you leave. Generally, you should head inland, although that doesn't always work, as Helene proved by devastating western North Carolina. Hurricanes do, however, gain strength over warm ocean waters and normally lose strength quickly as they get further inland. If there isn't time, most coastal municipalities will have designated a sturdy building as a hurricane shelter. Know where yours is. Have a go bag. Always have a set of supplies ready to take with you on short notice. Non-perishable food, bottled water, extra clothing, flashlights and batteries, a NOAA weather radio, medicines, and a first aid kit, I know we can find some good ones, are just a few of the items that'll help ensure your survival. Although you'll see recommendations to have a 72-hour supply, this figure, honestly, is pretty arbitrary. A week's worth would be even better. Have a cell phone charger. Communication is key. Have cash on hand. Power for credit card verification could be down after a hurricane. If you don't have some cash and small bills on hand, you have a power shortage. That is purchasing power. Let's say you haven't received an evacuation order and you're going to ride out the storm in place. Here are some considerations you're going to want to take into account. Let's start with food. Keep it cold. Have the refrigerator and freezer down to their lowest settings so that food will take longer to spoil if the power goes out. Collect ice. Collect ice in plastic bags and place them throughout the fridge to prolong freshness. If there are open spots, fill plastic containers with water, freeze them, and place in the spaces. The fuller the fridge is, the longer the items in it will stay cool. Wrap it in foil. Wrap food items in aluminum foil, eliminating air pockets, and cram the foil packs together as closely as you can. Cook them and freeze them. Cook your meats before the hurricane gets close and freeze them. As cooking requires fuel, have full propane tanks or charcoal briquettes in your supplies for when the power goes out. Keep it closed. Don't leave the refrigerator door open while deciding what food to take out. Close it as quickly as possible. Of course, there are always perishable items. Eat them first and save the canned foods for later. And don't forget to buy a hand-operated can opener in case of a power failure. Don't know how many times I've seen people only have an electric can opener. Let's talk about water. There's water everywhere, but floodwaters are usually contaminated. Have a stockpile of 5-gallon bottles of clean water for a plentiful supply of smaller bottles. Fill every bathtub with water. Now, you might think this is overkill, but every member of your family needs at least a gallon of water per day. It goes fast. Drink the melted ice. As refrigerated ice in containers melts, don't waste them. Use it as an additional source of drinking water. Hot water heaters hold, well, water. Hot water heaters have gallons and gallons of drinkable water. Don't hesitate to raid them if you get low. Turn off the electricity or gas and follow the instructions for removing water from your particular brand. There might be some sediment you'll have to filter. Be aware of that. Speaking of filters, make sure you have one. Handheld filters like the Life Straw or Mini Sawyer, or larger ones like the Berkey, can be useful to deal with questionable water. Know how to disinfect water. Don't expect debris-laden floodwaters to be clean enough to drink. Have some household bleach available to make water safe to ingest. 8 drops per gallon should do the job for clear water, 16 drops for cloudy. 16 drops of tincture of iodine will also work. Allow 30 minutes, though, before drinking to let the chemicals work their magic. Let's talk about shelter. You can have food and water, but if you're stuck out there in the elements, your chances of surviving might be pretty slim. Make sure to put up the shutters. If you have hurricane shutters, put them up at least 24 hours before hurricane landfall. Don't delay until the last minute. It is no fun to have to stand on a ladder in gale force winds and pouring rain to install them. I've been there and I've done that. Don't ask. Move furniture and potted plants inside. If you can't for some reason, chain them together against an outer wall downwind from the direction of the storm. Prune trees. Prune all trees near your home so that wind can easily flow through the crowns. Otherwise, expect some to be downed by the storm, maybe right on top of you. Branches, fruit, in South Florida, coconuts can be cannonballs, and other debris can be deadly in high winds. Pick a safe room. That's going to be very important. Choose a room in the interior of the home, preferably one without windows. It might be tempting to take a selfie out there in the storm, but it might be your last one. Place candles in pans. Candles can be knocked over by winds and cause fires. If you must use them, stick them in a pan with shiny sides that'll be deep enough to cover the flame. Have tarps at the ready. Large tarps can be used to cover windows and after the storm, any areas of the roof that might have been damaged. Don't expect roofers to be waiting for your call. They're going to be in demand. I remember it took more than a year for all the tarps to disappear down here after Hurricane Wilma in 2005. And there's sandbags, of course. Sandbags may help protect your home from flooding if it's less than maybe, oh, I don't know, about 2 feet high. Fill them half full of sand, if available, of course, or soil if that's what you got. Fold the top of the sandbag down and the rest of the bag on the folded top. Tamp each sandbag into place. Now, once your shelter's in order, there are other important considerations. The kids. Have board games, toys, and books to keep the kids' minds off scary winds. If you're evacuating, let kids bring their favorite stuffed animal, blanket, or pillow to keep them calm. Then there are your other kids. Don't forget to take into account the needs of your pets. Have food, water, and their favorite toy available. Now, whether you stay home or leave, remember, municipal shelters are going to have supplies for you, but maybe they don't have supplies for your pet. And then there's your other kid. Make sure your car is in good condition and filled with gas. Have some spare gas cans around. That's going to be useful in case of a shortage at the pumps. They can also be used to run generators, although never inside or at the entrance of your home. You should also protect your documents. Place important papers like birth certificates, passports, insurance documents, and others in waterproof containers. Scan them and send them to yourself using email or other methods. A NOAA weather radio, battery-powered or hand-cranked, will be an important source of information on the progress of the storm and for community alerts and updates. And stay in touch. Whether you stay or go, let the rest of the family know your plans and how to reach you. Know that voice calls may be difficult during or after a storm. Cell companies count on no more than about a 20% call capacity at any one time. Texts, however, seem to go through more easily than voice calls, even in high-volume settings. Being prepared for a hurricane can make sure that the storm will be just a bump on the road, not the end of the road for you and your family. Have a plan of action, get some supplies, and you'll keep it together even when everything else falls apart. This is Joel Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook. Get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
So listening to Bones on that segment, it's good advice for hurricanes and other storms, but it's good advice in general. And it just comes back around to what I've said for 16 years about preparedness. We don't prepare for specific disasters, hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, pandemics, whatever. We prepare to deal without systems of support, and we prepare to not be able to stay where we are, and we prepare to be able to stay where we are without systems of support. That's the whole of preparedness right there when you really think about it. Because it doesn't matter why you have to leave your house, it matters that you have to leave your house. It doesn't matter why you don't have a system of support, it matters that. So, anyway, great segment by Bones and indeed very timely. I want to talk to you guys now more about education. You know this is a big hot topic with me. It's something I've been pounding on for years, and I'm beginning to see it come to fruition in a lot of ways, and I'm going to talk about some of those today. But I also want to kind of just lead off with what prompted this discussion for my anchor segment. And, you know, the question basically I'm trying to answer here is what happens when 90% of useful education becomes free or cheap and on demand? I mean, you have to wait until the next semester starts or whatever. I want to take a course on how to program cloud computing applications for, I don't know, the traffic industry, whatever, you know. And you just go find one and start taking it immediately, and it doesn't cost anything, or it costs a very small amount of money. And what happens is a lot more colleges and a lot more, you know, schools in general go out of business. They go out of business. And if you think about it, this makes perfect sense. Why wouldn't that happen? Why would education... Now, I can tell you, we do have to answer that question leading into it. Why has it held out so long? And that's because there is an awful lot of people that make an awful lot of money with the system the way it is now, and I'm talking a lot of money, not teachers, right? I'm talking everybody from administrators up to people that write textbooks, to people that, you know, supply food to schools for lunches. Even though the food is dog shit, the contract is very, very valuable. There's a lot of money in the education system as it sits right now. There's a lot of money in taking the garbage away from a school, okay? There's a ton of money in providing cleaning supplies to schools. You understand this? Whenever you have an industry this large, there's tons of money attached to it. So there's been a good protective bubble around it. But the other side of it is automation and all these different technologies we have are going to affect it. And let's just compare it to some other technologies that disrupted, you know, fairly large employment pools. If we just go back about 50 to 55 years, most women didn't work, but most women that did work, if they, you know, if they weren't like waitresses or something like that, they worked in a thing called a typing pool. So companies had these vast pools of women that would sit at typewriters all day long and type things. You know, there'd be dictation would come out and we'd copies made of it, or forms that need to fill out, and it was carbon paper. This is before we even had, let alone computers and printers, before we even had, you know, broad scale use of copying machines. Then Xerox came out, and you could just one copy and stick it in there and push 50, and 50 came out. And then word processing machines came out, and, you know, you could hit print, you know, collate and print 20 copies. And there's no such thing as a typing pool anymore. There's no such thing as a typing pool. And this is so recent, really, that when I was in high school, we had different curriculums we could go with, and I went with like a business curriculum because that got me into business law courses, accounting, and things like that. But it also had some bullshit in it, like, you know, typing. And as we're learning to type, the teacher's telling us, you're not going to use typewriters. I mean, we had old school electric typewriters with a little ball thing that went back and forth, and when you made a mistake, you had to use like whiteout. You learned how to squeeze letters into, because you left a letter out of a word, but you're done with the whole thing, and now you got to make it fit. You push it halfway back. Like, that's what we learned. But we also learned other things, like, you know, 10-keying on an adding machine. And 10-key is still valuable when I'm doing certain things with accounting. I still use a 10-key skill, but on a computer, not on an adding machine with a tape that I used to have to turn in with an assignment. And so those things, right, that I'm talking about right there, like 10 key on an adding machine and all, that all goes back to the kind of that era around the typing pool. There were still, you know, I remember girls graduating in my high school who were going on to McCann School of Business. It basically, you were going to like have like another year or two of that kind of bullshit, learning how to file. And it was all okay. So that all went away because technology made it obsolete. You go back, you know, just keep going back and look at all the places that happened. We can go back 100-ish years. You used to go to a big building, like in New York City, and you get an elevator. It's an elevator operator. There was a skill involved in it. You know, why do we have that? Well, you know, it employs a lot of people, but eventually you just push a button. Go back 20 years here in Dallas, Texas, and everywhere you went, there was an option for Easy Pass, but there's also a dude sitting in the toll booth making change. That was held on to by gilding, like unions, etc. Especially, it was really held on to, like in New Jersey and New York and all, because, well, we have to keep these people employed. But eventually, technology won out. In Texas now, you don't have an Easy Pass. That's okay. We'll send you a bill in the mail for twice as much money with a picture of your license plate. And that's what they do. So there is a long history of technology replacing things. There's also technology-based solutions can only be built for as much as they are accepted, desired, and immune from reproduction of something that does the same thing, and then the base cost of production. So I mentioned, you know, an adding machine. We don't use adding machines. We use calculators that are on our phones and our computers that everybody has access to. The latest iPhone calculators will do calculations, advanced calculations. They'll even do currency conversions. None of you know that the latest rendition of iOS on the iPhone does currency conversions, which probably means Android's had it for 2 years, right? But what does that app cost you? Absolutely nothing. Because anybody can whip up that app in seconds, and it costs zero cost of delivery. So when you take a look at a product, there's a cost to produce it and a cost to deliver it that goes into what are called the COGS, which is the cost of goods sold of an item. Okay? So what's the cost of goods sold of an education for, let's say, I don't know, a course on Sumerian history that you might take in a university? Well, that teacher teaches that class 4 or 5 times a day, every day for years and years and years. You have to keep paying that teacher. But I can take that same course, can film it. The exams can be administered with technology, and the cost of goods sold on that becomes how much I have to pay the content developer to develop that content or do it myself. And the cost of delivery now becomes almost nothing. So it's a race to zero, or as close to zero as you can get and still make a profit and still sell. So what happens to education? It goes the same way eventually. And it's already happening. And I want to give you some examples of how it's happening that I'm seeing right now. One, I have two people in my family, and they're in my family through marriage. I'll just leave it at that. Don't spend a lot of time with them or anything, but they're both teachers. They're a married teacher couple. One just retired early, and the other one's about to retire early, and they're not retiring early. They're quitting. And what I mean by that is, yeah, they have their retirement or whatever, but a teacher in Texas does not have a retirement like a teacher maybe in Chicago with like a city pension, kind of like old school military style, like you do 30 years or whatever, and you get paid X for the rest of your life and get help. No. Teachers in most states don't have shit like that. What they have is a different version of a 401k. Okay, so that they have their own pension fund that they've self-funded. And maybe they had matching funds and all, but when they say they're retiring, most people hear a retired teacher, they think, oh, they're going to turn their packet in and they're going to get a check every month. It doesn't work that way here. It doesn't work that way here for cops either. But this is what's interesting. Why are they retiring? Well, they both work for Fort Worth School District, and it's not a great school district to work in. They're both older folks. They're older than myself. They're like in their 60s. They can't get a job at a better school district. And one of them just, I think, is just beat on the whole thing. And the other one was like, I'll stay. And she was doing like special ed classes, small numbers of kids at a time. And they put her back into like dealing with 30 kids at once. And she said, I can't do it anymore. And they said, tough. So what's interesting to me is you would think a person with a teaching degree with that many years of experience could just go to a better district in better conditions and get a job. No, can't. I just talked to somebody else who I have a really, really high opinion of, middle-aged guy, early middle age, like 40-ish, has a history of teaching, has taught at the collegiate level, applied to a bunch of high schools, nobody's biting, can't get a job. Really? I have another family member who's a teacher. She's on the edge of retiring early, which really means quitting herself, and is probably going to make this her last year. Same scenario. Not happy with the school district she's at. She's in a better school district than the first people I mentioned, but can't, like, move up in the world. Can't, like, get a job in Southlake or something, like, you know, where kids are well-behaved and all the parents are wealthy and there's no trouble. No, you got to stay where you are because nobody's hiring. And she is doing special ed, and they basically threw her in a closet with no air conditioning. Now, what this all says to me is that we have a dying industry that you're being lied to about. You're still being told the teachers are heroes that don't wear capes. You're still being told if you get a degree in education, you won't make a lot of money, but you'll always have a job. But this is all bullshit. We have major affluent school districts around here closing and folding schools in on each other. Plano School District is closing 3 elementary and 3 middle schools after this year and saying we're not laying anybody off. Well, how are you doing that? Well, the way they're doing that is that they're encouraging early retirement, again, which isn't retirement, and they're practicing reduction through attrition. That's why people that are trying to get jobs as teachers are not getting jobs. And they're certainly not going to hire somebody that they think has 5 years left in their career. They're going to hire somebody young and stupid and doesn't know the ropes yet and is still excited and still believes. They're going to hire somebody out of college for cheap versus somebody experienced for money. And they're only doing that as they actually have to, and there's plenty of body count out there to hire however many they need. I keep hearing how all these schools need teachers, but whenever I talk to somebody who's teaching and looking for a job, and they can't get one. So I'm sure somebody's going to write me, and I'm sure I will just concede in advance, yes, yes, in your little utopia where you live, where things are still in growth mode or whatever, yes, right there, teachers can get jobs. And if half of the teachers looking for jobs applied where you were at, then like 99% of them wouldn't get one because that would fill the gap. So there are always like supply-demand pinch points. So if you see that, don't let it negate what I'm telling you. This is a mega trend. This is a mega trend. We do not have the body count of students continuing to grow. It is, in fact, in decline. That's the student enrollment cliff that hits the colleges next year. That means it's already hit the grade schools, the middle schools, and the high schools. That's why they're the canaries in the coal mine, and they're going first. Right now, like I said, when you look at college, it's even worse. It's even worse. And right now we have 600-plus free on-demand AI and cloud computing courses just from Amazon, and there's over 10,000 free courses from tech giants. Let me tell you something about these courses. They're all things that those companies want people to know how to do because there's no point for these companies in putting out these courses and providing the infrastructure and doing it all for free unless they get something. There is no free lunch. There is no free lunch. Amazon's doing this because there's not enough people with AI and cloud computing skill sets to hire. So they're doing it because it's cheaper to do that than to go on this deep recruiting, and you can look right at who's in your student body, what they're doing. You can see how good they are. It's the best recruiting funnel they've ever built. That's why Microsoft's doing it. That's why Intel's doing it. Okay, that's why all, and I got links to both of these resources in the show notes today if you want to take a look at it. But again, this is what people aren't understanding. This is the dying death spiral of a multi-trillion dollar industry. Again, it won't all go away, but the when I say death, what I'm saying is give it 5-10 years, you won't recognize the space anymore. You won't recognize the space. More than half of what people pay to learn in college is bullshit. I don't even care if you have a great degree, you have a STEM degree, and you're an engineer or whatever. It's still the case that half of what you learned is useless to you. Useless to you. Now, when you start paying $25,000, $35,000 a year for 4 years or 5 years or 6 years, you know, master's, PhD level in some case, 8 years, when half of what you're paying for is useless, you start to pay attention to that. And if somebody gives you an opportunity to get you to the same place for less money without the bullshit, you're going to take it. This is only the beginning. The world is going to shift in ways you cannot imagine as it comes to education, because the reality is the vast majority of what we need to educate people how to do, that can be delivered for almost nothing. Now, I actually see a business opportunity in this. There's over 10,000 courses. They're all free. Where do you start? What do you do? I actually see there's going to be an opportunity for people to create like third-party curation platforms that say, if you want to do this, then we have like all the places where to go, what to do, and guidance through it, and what to do outside that system. And how I see people building their own educational platforms, leveraging these free educational platforms. And I'm sure there's some prohibition against it, as much as I'm sure there are ways around it, I guarantee you. Just like I can run a course and say, you should buy this book by Matt Powers and read it before you take my course as a prerequisite. You see what I'm saying? I see tremendous opportunity here for disruption and for participation as a disruptor. I also see that there's going to be a lot of things that these companies will never teach people how to do because they don't care. I run an educational platform called Home Food Systems. I have courses there on composting. I have a course there on cover cropping. I don't see Amazon ever providing that to you. So what we're getting to is a point where people not only are realizing the lack of value that you obtain by going to a university, but they still want to learn, and they're realizing, I can learn all this shit here and this other stuff that I want to learn, somebody will provide that to me in an a la carte fashion, where I pay for what I want. And by the way, if I don't think I got my value out of it, most, I give you 60 days for a refund. You don't think you got your value? Here's your money back. Go ask the college that you got a degree from, and you can't get a fucking job now, for a refund, and see what they tell you. GFY, that's what they're going to tell you. So this entire space is going to shift, and up till now, I've mostly spoken about the cost of that or the negative of that. I want you to start thinking about the positive and how you can participate in it. There's going to be so much call for homeschool, and there's going to be so much call for adjunctive things for homeschoolers. You know, I mean, the thing about that is you have to be good. You have to be really good. So you can be a lackluster teacher, get hired, and keep a job for 30 years. But you can't be a lackluster teacher and be an entrepreneur and keep a student body growing for 30 years. Those are different things. But there is tremendous opportunity there. With that, let's go ahead and wrap up today. I want to remind you guys real quick, if you want to support us, one of the things we do have is that educational platform. Check it out at homefoodsystems.com. Remember, MSB members get discounts on all the courses there. Those are available in your back office of the MSB. And think about joining the MSB, because if you do that, you'll help us out by, you know, basically paying about 18 cents an episode for the show. And then you get a ton of discounts that more than covers the cost. You can learn more by going to thesurvivalpodcast.com and clicking on members. With that, I'll wrap up for the day. I'll catch you with a Friday flashback tomorrow, and we'll do it all over again next week.
They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a bed.